This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I'll speak with Brigette M. Davis about her memoir, Love, Rita, an American story of sisterhood, joy, loss, and legacy. In the memoir, Love, Rita, the eponymous Rita is the older sister of author Brigette M. Davis. Rita was 4 years older than Brigette. Family lore tells that Rita once told a very baby Brigette, "Shut your damn mouth." The incongruity of a four-year-old saying that to an infant can be unexpected and humorous, and maybe it spoke to a tiny seed of sisterly rivalry that was planted just then. But these sisters also grew to be very close, with a bond that was fortified by their love for their family and each other. Rita was vivacious. She blazed trails as the first in the family to go to college. At age 16, she was a car test driver, an amateur belly dancer, an MBA, and a beloved special education teacher. And then Rita was diagnosed with lupus. What's it like to be a Black woman in America, in a country where implicit bias can be part of healthcare, where people of color are chronically exposed to social and economic disadvantages that pointedly affect the health of Black men and women? Love, Rita is an emotional portrait of sisterhood, with the real challenges of rivalry and growing up with big dreams in a world not created to make our lives easier in realizing them. It's a story about the persistent effects of racism in the lives of Black men and women. It's a story of heartbreak and loss. It's a story about the joys of sisterhood, too, and the abiding love that Rita and Brigette forged for each other through it all. I spoke to author Brigette M. Davis about her memoir, Love, Rita, an American story of sisterhood, joy, loss, and legacy. Love, Rita, can you just tell us a little bit about this book? And I suppose by telling us about the book, you'll tell us a little bit about Rita.
Yes. So I decided to write this book after I wrote a letter to my sister on what would have been her 65th birthday. She had already passed like 20 years before, and I just wanted to honor that milestone birthday. But in the process of writing the letter, I realized it was very upsetting. I was getting emotional, and I had to acknowledge that, honestly, despite two decades having passed, I was not over losing her. I had not really grieved. And for me as a writer, the way to really confront that is to decide to really write about a loved one. And so that began the journey for me. I thought, you want to be in a relationship with her again. And when you write about someone, that's exactly what happens.
That's so profound. Well, tell me about writing letters. So many letters in this book from a variety of people, in fact. Can you tell me about this kind of epistolary thing that happens in this book? It's so interesting to me.
I always wanted to have a reason to put letters in a book. When I wrote my second novel, I made it epistolary in a lot of places because I'm just attracted to the whole idea of how you convey what you feel and what you feel for someone else through letters. I mean, I'm of an age where I used to write letters to people and receive them, and they were always gifts. You know, the sense of intention and focus and the time you take, it's a love letter no matter what's in it. That's how I feel. And so Rita, I realized, and I had written a lot of letters to one another. More remarkably, I saved them and I bound them with a ribbon after she passed. And let me say, Yvette, I have no memory of putting those letters together and wrapping them with a ribbon. I have no memory of that. I just know that when I finally decided to write the book, I opened the trunk where I stored all of her things after she died. There on top was literally this bundle of letters. That really determined how I would write the book. I knew right away. And in fact, that's where the title comes from.
That's incredible. I mean, because we try to get rid of ephemera, we try to get rid of paper, and we try to get rid of things like letters and forms and all kinds of things, old bills and statements. And I think it's just almost miraculous that you save the letters to begin with, but then also that they appear so magically in that bundle.
I have never had anything so magical happen, really. I feel as though it sounds, you know how people say things sound woo-woo? But I have to tell you, it is really what happened. And then I saw the natural narrative arc as I was reading these letters from her. Like, I don't have the letters that I wrote to her. They're gone.
Yeah.
So I was filling in the narrative, you know, imagining what I had written to her based on what she wrote to me. And I could see that these letters literally moved through the arc of our relationship from the time I was 12 and she went away to college and wrote me the very first letter until the last year of her life.
And she was so young when she went to college, right?
She was only 16 when she went to college.
Her story. Tell me about, well, first tell me, what is it about sisters, this particular relationship that makes it such a rich context for storytelling, but also just you and your sister? It's just such a, it is a story worth sharing. It is such an interesting story.
Yeah, thank you. I have this belief and have for some time, as someone who had three sisters, I have always believed that it is the great untold love story because it's so complex and unique unto itself. I can't really think of anything in popular culture, and I'm thinking now as we are talking, that really begins to truly capture the complexity of that relationship and its intensity, its beauty, its like ugliness. Because I feel that when you see depictions in films, TV, books of sisters, they feel, in my opinion, very flattened and not in any way capturing the beauty and the pathos of it. And so I already wanted an opportunity, a reason to explore that really special relationship. And so I guess you could say a lot of things came together for me to move forward and write Love, Rita. It felt like the right, it felt I was engaged and interested in the topic and I needed to write it.
There's something so gorgeous about the complexity, about the ugliness, about, you know, the rivalry or the jealousy or the times you didn't get along, because I think it's such a hard-won love. It's such a real kind of love underneath it all. So I think for storytelling, it is the perfect subject. As you say, it is a kind of a love story because it has this inherent complexity, you know, it just is that way. And to paint it as something so pure and without any flaws and without any snags, I think is not really a story. You know, that's something else.
So, I agree.
Yeah. So there's something about this story that, because the love that was so hard won, that is so hard won, it still is a perfect kind of love, even though the relationship was very complicated. You said woo-woo, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm having that kind of day, maybe because I knew I was going to talk to you. I don't know. Something kind of magical. But tell me about numbers and about the number four.
Yeah. So I grew up in a house of numbers. My first memoir, The World According to Fannie Davis, is all about my mother's life in the Detroit numbers. She was what we call a numbers runner, basically running this underground lottery that preceded what we have today as the lottery. And she gave us a middle-class life with that. It was never a family secret, but it was a secret outside of the family. And so numbers are as natural to me as breathing. And in our family, and I would say in our in African American culture more broadly, numbers carry meaning. They carry meaning, they carry power. And so I wanted to really tap into that as I wrote this book about Rita, because I knew her personal number, but as I was working on the book, I couldn't believe all of the different ways that that number was presenting itself. Her number was four. She was the fourth child in the family. She was born in the fourth month of the year. Her name has four letters in it. I mean, it went on and on. And actually, she died at age 44.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing to me. And that's not it. There are other fours, right?
There are many others. Yeah, it's like, yeah, you know, she retired at age 40. She had four best friends. She had these four beautiful years that she lived in these lovely apartments in downtown Detroit that are situated on the Detroit River. And so the view is spectacular. You know, it was just, I was 40 when I lost her, you know. Fours kept coming up. It took me 4 years to write the book. Well, to actually, from the moment I committed to the book until it was out in the world this spring was 4 years.
That's just amazing to me. And your childhood was, well, it's marked by this proximity to Rita. I mean, compared to your other siblings who were older than you. But she was born, as you say, during a sort of a different era in your parents' marriage. Even place figures into it. You write in the book that she likely remembered the stress of poverty in the womb, right? Those kinds of things that she experienced. And your mother, Fanny, was pregnant when Emmett Till was tortured and murdered. And you cite the work of a Dutch biologist named Frans de Waal, who said, "We are bodies born of other bodies."
Isn't that a beautiful quote? I
It is
mean,
so
it says
beautiful.
so much.
But can you talk about this in regards to Rita? And there's actually more to say about this idea and about weathering. But I wonder if you can just explain that part of it briefly. This idea that when a woman is pregnant, that the baby in the womb can experience a lot more than we might think.
Yes, for sure. Let me just say that Rita was also 4 years older than I. There's that four again. But yeah, I really believe that every child is born into a different family, no matter you have the same parents, because life is different at that moment for each child, right? And for Rita, as compared to myself, she had so many challenges that took place even before she was born. And you're right. My mother often told the story that she was pregnant with Rita. She saw this image of Emmett Till in the only publication that would actually print the photo, which was Jet Magazine. And she said, "I almost had a miscarriage from the shock." And so I just started thinking as I was working on the book, what could that have done to that poor little baby Rita, that fetus? That is stress that scientists now have confirmed that fetuses do experience that stress. And what the mother is going through impacts the baby. So this was the beginning of her life, which helped me to understand why she had a stress-related disease later in life.
And also, she was born breech, right?
And she was born breech, and it was a very difficult birth. They both, mother and child, almost didn't make it. This is 1956. As you might imagine, my mom newly migrated to the north to Detroit, dealing with poverty that they didn't experience in their hometown of Nashville, but the migration prompted that poverty that, you know, and then they found all this racism in Detroit they weren't prepared for. And I'm sure in the context of, you know, giving birth in a public hospital, she couldn't possibly have gotten the real care she needed. And so imagine giving, you know, delivering a baby breech in that environment. And it really helped me to understand, finally, with great empathy and compassion, the bond between Rita and my mother, which when I was younger, I was jealous of. And then I began to understand what it started with, where it came from, what it meant, why they were so connected.
And there's another aspect of this story about, I mean, this is also a very researched sort of book. I mean, it is a story about your sister and your relationship, but also about her experiences with lupus. But there's so much more here. For example, in writing about her being a breech baby, you discuss this idea about implicit bias.
Mm-hmm.
And these numbers are fascinating to me. You say that breech babies delivered by white doctors are up to 58% more likely to die than those delivered by black. I mean, that's astonishing. That's outrageous. But there's more to the story than just that in terms of medical care and so many other things that people of color have to experience. And it's something that you weave into the story of Rita, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes another aspect of her life and also of your relationship with her. Even the idea that you offer about why babies sometimes don't turn in the mother's womb. But this idea of what a baby can experience on top of that, then also is the idea of poverty or the stressors out there in the world, including something like racism or this kind of bias. So it's just so fascinating to me how you wove these elements into this book.
Oh, thank you. I just don't think people can fully appreciate the insidiousness of racism, how it infiltrates itself, you know, into every aspect of life. And I wanted a way to try to really help bring that concept to the fore. And I also was trying to answer this unanswerable question. Why, Rita? Why was she one of the 250 Black women who will have lupus? Meaning one in every 250 Black women suffers from lupus. That's a lot.
Yeah.
But also it makes me ask, why was she one? Why was she that one of that number of 250 women? Why? And so I just decided to explore all of the aspects of her life that were impacted and to think about what that did to her and did to her body and did to her immune system and did to her, ability to manage stress. I mean, you mentioned weathering. That was a concept that blew my mind when I read about it initially, because it gave a word to what I always believed. I always believed that Black folks suffer disproportionately from various diseases, not because they're Black, mm-hmm. which is what people want you to believe. Well, Black folks, and, you know, they eat the wrong foods, or they have bad genes, bad luck, bad behavior. But in fact, no, they have greater stressors on them, on us, I'll say, in every aspect of life. And because we weather our way through those conditions doesn't mean that the experience isn't weathering our bodies.
I was thinking about what you just said about why Rita, why Rita? And I was thinking about how accomplished she was and the tremendous things that she managed to do in her lifetime. And she had many interesting roles. She was a car test driver.
Yes.
She was a special education teacher. I mean, the things that she did I don't know of anyone who did so many diverse things in her life. And I wonder how the diagnosis of lupus changed the dynamic between you and your sister. I know it had an effect, for instance, on her. She could not return to the classroom. But How did that dynamic change? You have this line in the book where you say, I can pinpoint exactly when Rita's disease began to shift in its severity, May 1994. And that was when she had to go to the hospital for treatment. And I wonder about that. It's so interesting to me that there's a moment when you can say exactly when the disease shifted in severity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think too about how that must have just, the disease must have just eclipsed all of this kind of joy she had in doing so many diverse things.
Yeah, it was really hard because what it's hard sometimes to appreciate is that a chronic illness can be managed for many years until it can't be. And she was diagnosed so young, only 20. So by the time she passed, she had experienced lupus and lived with it for quite a while, for basically 24 years, which is not a lot in a lifetime, but a long time to manage a disease. And she was doing just that. But then in that month of 1994, May, I saw a shift. Suddenly, the symptoms were more severe and it was taking its toll in a new way. As she put it, the lupus has gone wacky.
And I was thinking too about this, this cruelty in that timing. Your sister was not able to return to teaching, but oh my gosh, how heartrending are those letters that you include from the students?
I know.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, more letters, right?
More letters. I love the letters in this book.
Yeah.
Your sister was a reader too. What would she say about this book? What do you think?
I think she'd be really tickled, you know. She really didn't live her life for it to be captured this way. She wasn't trying to make a mark on the world in that way. And yet, I like to think that she'd feel I captured what makes her special, you know, that makes her memorable. I'd like to think she'd be really proud of the way I captured her caring for our mom, her love of her friends, her close relationships, her fabulous, dynamic, exciting love life. I think it's a beautiful thing to know that someone is not their illness.
Oh, yeah.
They're so much more than that. And they're not the way they died. They're really the way they lived. I would love to believe she'd really be pleased that I was able to depict her in a way that makes so many people who've read the book who say to me, I wish I'd known her.
I was going to say the same thing. And I look at that picture of the two of you on the cover and I think, oh, wow, I wish I had known her. You know,
yeah.
There's so much about this book that's so remarkable. And just one of those things is this epilogue.
Mm.
It's a gorgeous and very poignant essay about how Rita would have loved living in the 21st century. And it's just so, it's this astonishing catalog of things and situations and technologies and pop culture and personalities and events, like so many things that you cover from the last 25 years in this, you know, digital age. So I was thinking, oh my gosh, yes, between 2000 and 2025, we're like on a different planet. And what's so amazing is that we get to know even more about Rita from your essaying what she might have loved, what she might not have liked so much. And it becomes this real look at Rita in 2025. And you just
so happy to hear
bring
that.
Her back. You bring her back. And it's, I feel like we know her in 2025. The book does this so beautifully, but the epilogue becomes this sort of exclamation mark or something of being able to know her more fully in this space that we are in right now. And you allowed that to happen. It's just such a powerful, the whole book is, but it's just to end the book this way, the epilogue, it's almost like, wow, it is such an exclamation mark.
You are the first person to say it to me in just that way, that, and I honestly hadn't really thought of it that way, that I'm bringing her into the 21st century and allowing you to know her as she would be now. It was really prompted by a much more selfish impulse. I was thinking about all the ways I missed her and what it would might have been like to still have her in my life in what has been such a seismic like moment in history, right?
Yeah. But I love the way you imagine her Facebook posts and her Facebook friends and how she would have reacted to President Obama and just, yeah, it's like she just materialized in 2025 and we could see her. We could know her even more.
That's great. That's what I want. I wanted to honor her. You know, writing is definitely a form of creating a kind of immortality for my loved ones. And so this was my biggest effort ever. And I will admit my hardest effort. This was the toughest book I've ever written, but I was much clearer, I think, about what I wanted to do with it, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah.
Brigette Davis, thank you so much. I feel so honored, so happy, and so thrilled to get to talk to you about Love, Rita.
Thank you so much for just, you know, reading it with such intention. And you know, for this conversation, it means a lot to me. Thank you.
Brigette M. Davis is the author of Love, Rita, An American Story of Sisterhood, Joy, Loss, and Legacy. It's published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins. She's also the author of The World According to Fannie Davis, A Mother's Life in the Detroit Numbers. You can learn more about the author by going to her website at brigettedavis.com. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.